to the fletching, and he was dead. Everywhere there were horses down and men scrambling, and he saw a man who sat charging his rifle while blood ran from his ears. And he saw men with their revolvers disassembled, trying to fit the spare loaded cylinders they carried. And he saw men kneeling, who tilted and clasped their shadows on the ground. And he saw men lanced and caught up by the hair and scalped standing. And he saw the horses of war trample down the fallen. And a little white-faced pony with one clouded eye leaned out of the murk and snapped at him like a dog and was gone. Among the wounded some seemed dumb and without understanding, and some were pale through the masks of dust, and some had fouled themselves or tottered brokenly onto the spears of the savages. Now driving in a wild frieze of headlong horses, with eyes walled and teeth cropped, and naked riders with clusters of arrows clenched in their jaws and their shields winking in the dust, and up the far side of the ruined ranks in a piping of bone flutes, and dropping down off the sides of their mounts with one heel hung in the withers strap, and their short bows flexing beneath the outstretched necks of the ponies until they had circled the company and cut their ranks in two. And then rising up again, like funhouse figures, some with nightmare faces painted on their breasts, riding down the unhorsed Saxons and spearing and clubbing them, and leaping from their mounts with knives and running about on the ground with a peculiar bandy-legged trot, like creatures driven to alien forms of locomotion, and stripping the clothes from the dead, and seizing them up by the hair, and passing their blades about the skulls of the living and the dead alike, and snatching aloft the bloody wigs, and hacking and chopping at the naked bodies, ripping off limbs, heads, gutting the strange white torsos, and holding up great handfuls of viscera, genitals. Some of the savages so slathered up with gore they might have rolled in it like dogs. And some who fell upon the dying and sodomized them with loud cries to their fellows. And now the horses of the dead came pounding out of the smoke and dust, and circled with flapping leather and wild manes, and eyes whited with fear, like the eyes of the blind. And some were feathered with arrows, and some lanced through, and stumbling and vomiting blood, as they wheeled across the killing ground and clattered from sight again. Dust stanched the wet and naked heads of the scalped, who with the fringe of hair below their wounds and tonsured to the bone, now lay like maimed and naked monks in the blood-slaked dust. And everywhere the dying groaned and gibbered, and horses lay screaming.
Chapter 5. Adrift on the Bolson de Mapimi. Sprawl. Tree of dead babies. Scenes from a massacre. Sopilotes. The murdered in the church. Night among the dead. Wolves. The washers at the ford. A foot westward. A mirage. An encounter with bandits. Attacked by a vampire. Digging a well. A crossroads in the waste. The Clareta. Death of Sproul. Under arrest. The captain's head. Survivors. On to Chihuahua. The city. The prison. Toadvine. With darkness, one soul rose wondrously from among the new slain dead and stole away in the moonlight. The ground where he'd lain was soaked with blood and with urine from the voided bladders of the animals. And he went forth stained and stinking like some reeking issue of the incarnate dam of war herself. The savages had moved to higher ground, and he could see the light from their fires and hear them singing, a strange and plaintive chanting up there where they'd gone to roast mules. He made his way among the pale and dismembered, among the sprawled and leg-flung horses, and he took a reckoning by the stars and set off south afoot. The night wore a thousand shapes out there in the brush, and he kept his eyes to the ground ahead. Starlight and waning moon made a faint shadow of his wanderings on the dark of the desert, and all along the ridges the wolves were howling and moving north toward the slaughter. He walked all night, and still he could see the fires behind him. With daylight, he made his way toward some outcroppings of rock a mile across the valley floor. He was climbing among the strewn and tumbled boulders when he heard a voice calling somewhere in that vastness. He looked out over the plain, but he could see no one. When the voice called again, he turned and sat to rest, and soon he saw something moving along the slope, a rag of a man clambering toward him over the talus slides. Picking his way with care, looking behind him, the kid could see that nothing followed. He wore a blanket over his shoulders, and his shirt sleeve was ripped and dark with blood, and he carried that arm against him with his other hand. His name was Sproul. 8 of them had escaped. His horse had carried off several arrows, and it caved under him in the night, and the others had gone on, the captain among them. They sat side by side among the rocks and watched the day lengthen on the plain below.
"Did you not save any of your possibles?"
Sproul said. The kid spat and shook his head. He looked at Sproul.
"How bad is your arm?"
He pulled it to him.
"I've seen worse," he said.
They sat looking out over those reaches of sand and rock and wind.
"What kind of Indians was them?"
"I don't know." Sproul coughed deeply into his fist. He pulled his bloody arm against him.
"Damn if they ain't about a caution to the Christians," he said.
They laid up in the shade of a rock shelf until past noon, scratching out a place in the gray lava dust to sleep, and they set forth in the afternoon down the valley, following the war trail. And they were very small, and they moved very slowly in the immensity of that landscape. Come evening, they hove toward the rim rock again, and Sproul pointed out a dark stain on the face of the barren cliff. It looked like the black from old fires. The kid shielded his eyes. The scalloped canyon walls rippled in the heat like drapery folds.
"It might be a sheep," said Sproul.
"It's a long ways up there."
"Well, if you see any water closer, let's make for that."
The kid looked at him, and they set off. The sight lay up a draw, and their way was a jumble of fallen rock and scoria and deadly-looking bayonet plants. Small black and olive-colored shrubs blasted under the sun. They stumbled up the cracked clay floor of a dry watercourse. They rested and moved on. The seep lay high up among the ledges, Vados water dripping down the slick black rock, and monkey flower and death camas hanging in a small and perilous garden. The water that reached the canyon floor was no more than a trickle, and they leaned by turns with pursed lips to the stone like devouts at a shrine. They passed the night in a shallow cave above this spot, an old reliquary of flint nappings and ratchels scattered about on the stone floor, with beads of shell and polished bone and the charcoal of ancient fires. They shared the blanket in the cold, and Sproul coughed quietly in the dark, and they rose from time to time to descend and drink at the stone. They were gone before sunrise, and the dawn found them on the plain again. They followed the trampled ground left by the war party, and in the afternoon they came upon a mule that had failed and been lanced and left dead, and then they came upon another. The way narrowed through rocks, and by they came to a bush that was hung with dead babies. They stopped side by side, reeling in the heat. These small victims, 7, 8 of them, had holes punched in their underjaws, and were hung so by their throats from the broken stobs of a mesquite to stare eyeless at the naked sky. Bald and pale and bloated, larval to some unreckonable being. The castaways hobbled past. They looked back. Nothing moved. In the afternoon they came upon a village on the plain where smoke still rose from the ruins, and all were gone to death. From a distance it looked like a decaying brick kiln. They stood without the walls a long time, listening to the silence before they entered. They went slowly through the little mud streets. There were goats and sheep slain in their pens, and pigs dead in the mud. They passed mud hovels where people lay murdered in all attitudes of death in the doorways and the floors, naked and swollen and strange. They found plates of food half eaten, and a cat came out and sat in the sun and watched them without interest, and flies snarled everywhere in the still hot air. At the end of the street they came to a plaza with benches and trees where vultures huddled in foul black rookeries. A dead horse lay in the square, and some chickens were pecking in a patch of spilled meal in a doorway. Charred poles lay smoldering where the roofs had fallen through, and a burro was standing in the open door of the church. They sat on a bench, and Sproul held his wounded arm to his chest and rocked back and forth and blinked in the sun. "What do you want to do?" said the kid. "Get a drink of water?" "Other than that?" "I don't know." "You want to try and head back?" "To Texas?" "I don't know where else." "We'd never make it." "Well, you say." "I ain't got no say." He was coughing again. He held his chest with his good hand and sat as if he'd get his breath. "What have you got, a cold?"
"I got consumption."
"Consumption?" He nodded.
"I come out here for my health."
The kid looked at him. He shook his head and rose and walked off across the plaza toward the church. There were buzzards squatting among the old carved wooden corbels, and he picked up a stone and squealed it at them, but they never moved. The shadows had grown long in the plaza, and little coils of dust were moving in the parched clay streets. The carrion birds sat about the topmost corners of the houses with their wings outstretched in attitudes of exhortation, like dark little bishops. The kid returned to the bench and propped up one foot and leaned on his knee. Sproul sat as before, still holding his arm.
"Son of a bitch is dealing me misery," he said.
The kid spat and looked off down the street.
"We better just hold up here for tonight." "You reckon it'd be all right?"
"Who with?"
"What if them Indians was to come back?"
"What would they come back for?"
"Well, what if they was to?"
"They won't come back." He held his arm.
"I wish you had a knife on you," the kid said.
"I wish you did."
"There's meat here if a man had a knife."
"I ain't hungry."
"I think we gotta scout these houses and see what all's here."
"You go on."
"We need to find us a place to sleep."
Sproul looked at him.
"I don't need to go nowheres," he said.
"Well, you suit yourself."
Sproul coughed and spat.
"I aim to,"
he said. The kid turned and went on down the street. The doorways were low, and he had to stoop to clear the lintel beams, stepping down into the cool and earthy rooms. There was no furniture save pallets for sleeping, perhaps a wooden meal bin. He went from house to house. In one room, the bones of a small loom, black and smoldering. In another, a man, the charred flesh drawn taut, the eyes cooked in their sockets. There was a niche in the mud wall with figures of saints dressed in doll's clothes, the rude wooden faces brightly painted. Illustrations cut from an old journal and pasted to the wall, a small picture of a queen, a gypsy card that was the Four of Cups. There were strings of dried peppers and a few gourds, a glass bottle that held weeds. Outside, a bare dirt yard fenced with ocotillo and a round clay oven caved through where black curd trembled in the light within. He found a clay jar of beans and some dry tortillas, and he took them to a house at the end of the street where the embers of the roof were still smoldering, and he warmed the food in the ashes and ate, squatting there like some deserter scavenging the ruins of a city he'd fled. When he returned to the square, Sproul was gone. All about lay in shadow. He crossed the square and mounted the stone steps to the door of the church and entered. Sproul was standing in the vestibule. Long buttresses of light fell from the high windows on the western wall. There were no pews in the church, and the stone floor was heaped with the scalped and naked and partly eaten bodies of some 40 souls who'd barricaded themselves in this house of God against the heathen. The savages had hacked holes in the roof and shot them down from above, and the floor was littered with arrow shafts where they'd snapped them off to get the clothes from the bodies. The altars had been hauled down and the tabernacle looted, and the great sleeping god of the Mexicans routed from his golden cup. The primitive painted saints in their frames hung cocked on the walls, as if an earthquake had visited, and a dead Christ in a glass bier lay broken in the chancel floor. The murdered lay in a great pool of their communal blood. It had set up into a sort of pudding, crossed everywhere with the tracks of wolves or dogs, and along the edges it had dried and cracked into a burgundy ceramic. Blood lay in dark tongues on the floor, and blood grouted the flagstones, and it ran in the vestibule where the stones were cupped from the feet of the faithful and their fathers before them, and it had threaded its way down the steps and dripped from the stones among the dark red tracks of the scavengers. Sproul turned and looked at the kid as if he'd know his thoughts, but the kid just shook his head. Flies clambered over the peeled and wigless skulls of the dead, and flies walked on their shrunken eyeballs. "Come on," said the kid. They crossed the square in the last of the light and went down the narrow street. In the doorway there lay a dead child with two buzzards sitting on it. Sproul shooed his good hand at the buzzards, and they baited and hissed and flapped clumsily, but they did not fly. They set forth in the morning with first light, while wolves slank from the doorways and dissolved in the fog of the streets. They went by the southwest road the way the savages had come. A little sandy stream, cottonwoods, three white goats. They waded a ford where women lay dead at their wash. They struggled all day across a terra damnata of smoking slag, passing from time to time the bloated shapes of dead mules or horses. By evening they had drunk all the water they carried. They slept in the sand and woke in the cool early morning dark and went on, and they walked the cinderland till they were near to fainting. In the afternoon they came upon a carreta in the trace, tilted on its tongue, the great wheels cut from rounds of a cottonwood trunk and pinned to the axle trees with tenons. They crawled under it for shade and slept until dark and went on. The rind of a moon that had been in the sky all day was gone, and they followed the trail through the desert by starlight, the Pleiades straight overhead and very small, and the Great Bear walking the mountains to the north.
"My arm stinks," said Sproul.
"What?"
"I said my arm stinks."
"You want me to look at it?"
"What for? You can't do nothing for it."
"Well, you suit yourself."
"I aim to,"
said Sproul. They went on. Twice in the night they heard the little prairie vipers rattle among the scrub, and they were afraid. With the dawn they were climbing among shale and whinstone under the wall of a dark monocline where turrets stood like basalt prophets. And they passed by the side of the road little wooden crosses propped in cairns of stone where travelers had met with death. The road winding up among the hills, and the castaways laboring upon the switchbacks, blackening under the sun, their eyeballs inflamed, and the painted spectra racing out at the corners. Climbing up through Ocotillo and Prickly Pear, where the rocks trembled and sleared in the sun. Rock and no water, and the sandy trace, and they kept watch for any green thing that might tell of water, but there was no water. They ate pinole from a bag with their fingers and went on. Through the noon heat and into the dusk, where lizards lay with their leather chins flat to the cooling rocks, and fended off the world with thin smiles and eyes like cracked stone plates. They crested the mountain at sunset, and they could see for miles. An immense lake lay below them, with the distant blue mountains standing in the windless span of water, and the shape of a soaring hawk and trees that shimmered in the heat, and a distant city, very white against the blue and shaded hills. They sat and watched. They saw the sun drop under the jagged rim of the earth to the west, and they saw it flare behind the mountains, and they saw the face of the lake darken, and the shape of the city dissolve upon it. They slept among the rocks face up like dead men. And in the morning when they rose, there was no city, and no trees, and no lake, only a barren, dusty plain. Sproul groaned and collapsed back among the rocks. The kid looked at him. There were blisters along his lower lip, and his arm through the ripped shirt was swollen, and something foul had seeped through among the darker bloodstains. He turned back and looked out over the valley. "Yonder comes somebody," he said. Sproul didn't answer. The kid looked at him. "I ain't lying," he said.
"Indians," said Sproul. "Ain't it?"
"I don't know. Too far to tell."
"What are you aiming to do?"
"I don't know."
"What happened to the lake?"
"I couldn't tell you."
"We both saw it."
"People see what they want to see."
"Then how come I ain't seeing it now? I sure as hell want to."
The kid looked out over the plain below.
"What if it's Indians?" said Sproul.
"Likely it will be."
"Where can we hide at?"
The kid spat dryly and wiped his mouth with the back of his hand. A lizard came out from under a rock and crouched on its small cocked elbows over that piece of froth and drank it dry and returned to the rock again, leaving only a faint spot in the sand, which vanished almost instantly. They waited all day. The kid made sorties down into the canyons in search of water, but he found none. Nothing moved in that purgatorial waste save carnivorous birds. By early afternoon, they could see the horsemen on the switchbacks coming up the face of the mountain below them. They were Mexicans. Sproul was sitting with his legs outstretched before him.
"I was worried about my old boots lasting me," he said.
He looked up.
"Go on," he said. "Save yourself."
He waved his hand. They were laid up under a ledge of rock in a narrow shade. The kid didn't answer. Within the hour, they could hear the dry scrabble of hooves among the rocks and the clank of gear. The first horse to round the point of rock and pass through the gap in the mountain was the captain's Big Bay, and he carried the captain's saddle, but he did not carry the captain. The refugees stood by the side of the road. The riders looked burnt and haggard coming up out of the sun, and they sat their horses as if they had no weight at all. There were 7 of them, 8 of them. They wore broad-brimmed hats and leather vests, and they carried escopetas across the pommels of their saddles. And as they rode past, the leader nodded gravely to them from the captain's horse and touched his hat brim, and they rode on. Sproul and the kid looked after them. The kid called out, and Sproul had started to trot clumsily along behind the horses. The riders began to slump and reel like drunks. Their heads lolled. Their guffaws echoed among the rocks, And they turned their mounts and sat them, and regarded the wanderers with huge grins.
¿Qué quiere?
Cried the leader. The riders cackled and slapped at one another. They had nudged their horses forward, and they began to ride them about without aim. The leader turned to the two afoot.
¿Buscan a los indios?
With this, some of the men dismounted and fell to hugging one another and weeping shamelessly. The leader looked at them and grinned, his teeth white and massive, made for foraging.
Loonies, said Sproul. They're loonies.
The kid looked up at the leader.
I'm about a drink of water, he said.
The leader sobered. He pulled a long face.
Water, he said.
We ain't got no water, said Sproul.
But my friend, how no? It's very dry here.
He reached behind him without turning, and a leather canteen was passed across the riders to his hand. He shook it and offered it down. The kid pulled the stopper and drank, and stood panting and drank again. The leader reached down and tapped the canteen.
Basta, he said.
He hung on, gulping. He couldn't see the horseman's face darken. The man shucked one boot backward out of the stirrup and kicked the canteen cleanly from between the kid's hands, leaving him there for a moment in a frozen gesture of calling. With the canteen rising and turning in the air and the lobes of water gleaming about it in the sun before it clattered to the rocks. Sproul scrambled after it and snatched it up where it lay, draining, and began to drink, watching over the rim. The horseman and the kid watched each other. Sproul sat back, gasping and coughing. The kid stepped across the rocks and took the canteen from him. The leader kneed his horse forward and drew a sword from its place beneath his leg, and leaning forward, ran the blade under the strap and raised it up. The point of the blade was about 3 inches from the kid's face, and the canteen strap was draped across the flat of it. The kid had stopped, and the rider raised the canteen gently from his hands and let it slide down the blade and come to rest at his side. He turned to the men and smiled, and they once again began to hoot and to pummel one another like apes. He swung the stopper up from where it hung by a thong and drove it home with the heel of his hand. He pitched the canteen to the man behind him and looked down at the travelers.
Why you no hide? He said.
From you?
From I.
We were thirsty.
Very thirsty, eh?
They didn't answer. He was tapping the flat of the sword lightly against the horn of his saddle, and he seemed to be forming words in his mind. He leaned slightly to them.
When the lambs is lost in the mountain, he said, they is cry. Sometime come the mother, sometime the wolf.
He smiled at them and raised the sword and ran it back where it had come from, and turned the horse smartly and trotted it through the horses behind him. And the men mounted up and followed, and soon all were gone. Sproul sat without moving. The kid looked at him, but he would look away. He was wounded in an enemy country, far from home. And although his eyes took in the alien stones about, yet the greater void beyond seemed to swallow up his soul. They descended the mountain, going down over the rocks with their hands outheld before them, and their shadows contorted on the broken terrain like creatures seeking their own forms. They reached the valley floor at dusk and set off across the blue and cooling land, the mountains to the west a line of jagged slate set endwise in the earth, and the dry weeds healing and twisting in a wind sprung from nowhere. They walked on into the dark, and they slept like dogs in the sand, and had been sleeping so, when something black flapped up out of the night ground and perched on Sproul's chest. Fine finger bones stayed the leather wings with which it steadied as it walked upon him. a wrinkled pug face, small and vicious, bare lips crimped in a horrible smile, and teeth pale blue in the starlight. It leaned to him. It crafted in his neck two narrow grooves, and folding its wings over him, it began to drink his blood. Not soft enough. He woke, put up a hand. He shrieked, and the blood bat flailed and sat back upon his chest and righted itself again and hissed and clicked its teeth. The kid was up and had seized a rock, but the bat sprang away and vanished in the dark. Sproul was clawing at his neck, and he was gibbering hysterically. And when he saw the kid standing there looking down at him, he held out to him his bloodied hands as if in accusation, and then clapped them to his ears and cried out what it seemed he himself would not hear, a howl of such outrage as to stitch a caesura in the pulse beat of the world. But the kid only spat into the darkness of the space between them.
"I know your kind," he said. "What's wrong with you is wrong all the way through you."
In the morning they crossed a dry wash, and the kid hiked up it, looking for a tank or a hole, but there was none. He picked out a sink in the wash and fell to digging with a bone, and after he had dug some 2 feet into the sand turned damp, and then a little more, and a slow seep of water began to fill into the furrows he dredged with his fingers. He took off his shirt and pushed it down into the sand and watched it darken, and he watched the water rise slowly among the folds of cloth until there was perhaps a cupful, and then he lowered his head into the excavation and drank. Then he sat and watched it fill again. He did this for over an hour. Then he put on the shirt and went back down the wash. Sproul didn't want to take off his shirt. He tried sucking up the water, and he got a mouthful of sand. "Why don't you let me use your shirt?" he said. The kid was squatting in the dry gravel of the wash. "Suck on your own shirt," he said. He took off the shirt. It stuck to the skin, and a yellow pus ran. His arm was swollen to the size of his thigh, and it was garishly discolored, and small worms worked in the open wound. He pushed the shirt down into the hole and leaned and drank. In the afternoon they came to a crossroads. What else to call it? A faint wagon trace that came from the north and crossed their path and went on to the south. They stood scanning the landscape for some guidance in that emptiness. Sproul sat where the tracks crossed and looked out from the great caves in his skull where his eyes lay. He said that he would not rise.
"Yonder's a lake," said the kid.
He would not look. It lay shimmering in the distance, its edges rimed with salt. The kid studied it and studied the roads. After a while he nodded toward the south.
"I believe this here is the most traveled." "It's all right," said Sproul. "You go on." "You suit yourself."
Sproul watched him set off. After a while, he rose and followed. They had gone perhaps 2 miles when they stopped to rest, Sproul sitting with his legs out and his hands in his lap, and the kid squatting a little ways from him, blinking and bearded and filthy in their rags.
"Does that sound like thunder to you?"
said Sproul. The kid raised his head.
"Listen."
The kid looked at the sky, pale blue, unmarked save where the sun burned like a white hole.
"I can feel it in the ground," said Sproul. "It ain't nothing." "Listen."
The kid rose and looked about. To the north, a small movement of dust. He watched it. It didn't rise, nor did it blow away. It was a carreta, lumbering clumsily over the plain, a small mule to draw it. The driver may have been asleep. When he saw the fugitives in the trace before him, he halted the mule and began to saw it around to go back,
and he did get it turned, but by then the kid had seized the raw leather headstall and hauled the animal to a standstill. Sproul came hobbling up. From the rear of the wagon, two children peered out. They were so pale with dust, their hair so white and faces pinched, they looked like little gnomes crouched there. At the sight of the kid before him, the driver shrank back, and the woman next to him set up a high, shrill chittering and began to point from one horizon to the other. But he pulled himself up into the bed of the cart, and Sproul came dragging after, and they lay staring up at the hot canvas tarp while the two waifs drew back into the corner and watched, black-eyed as wood mice. And the car turned south again and set off with a rising rumble and clatter. There was a clay jar of water hung by a thong from the bowstay, and the kid took it down and drank from it and gave it to Sproul. Then he took it back and drank the rest. They lay in the floor of the cart among old hides and spills of salt, and after a while they slept. It was dark when they entered the town. The jostle of the cart ceasing was what woke them. The kid raised himself up and looked out. Starlight in a mud street. The wagon empty. The mule wheezed and stamped in the traces. After a while, the man came from the shadows and led them along a lane into a yard, and he backed the mule until the cart was alongside a wall, and then he unhitched the mule and led it away. He lay back in the tilted cart bed. It was cold in the night, and he lay with his knees drawn up under a piece of hide that smelled of mold and urine, and he slept and woke all night, and all night dogs barked, and in the dawn cocks called, and he heard horses on the road. In the first gray light, flies began to land on him. They touched his face and woke him, and he brushed them away. After a while, he sat up. They were in a barren, mud-walled courtyard, and there was a house made of reeds and clay. Chickens stepped about and clucked and scratched. A small boy came from the house and pulled down his pants and shat in the yard and rose and went in again. The kid looked at Sproul. He was lying with his face to the wagon boards. He was partly covered with his blanket, and flies were crawling on him. The kid reached to shake him. He was cold and wooden. The flies rose, then they settled back. The kid was standing by the cart pissing when the soldiers rode into the yard. They seized him and tied his hands behind him, and they looked in the cart and talked among themselves, and then they led him out into the street. He was taken to an adobe building and put in an empty room. He sat on the floor while a wild-eyed boy with an old musket watched him. After a while, they came and took him out again. They led him through the narrow mud streets, and he could hear music, like a fanfare, growing the louder. First, children walked with him, and then old folk, and finally a throng of brown-skinned villagers all dressed in white cotton, like attendants in an institution. The women in dark rebosos, some with their breasts exposed, their faces stained red with almagre, smoking small cigars. Their numbers swelled, and the guards with their shouldered fusils frowned and shouted at the jostlers, and they went on along the tall adobe wall of a church and into the plaza. There was a bazaar in progress, a traveling medicine show, a primitive circus. They passed stout willow cages clogged with vipers, with great lime-green serpents from some more southerly latitude, or beaded lizards with their black mouths wet with venom. A reedy old leper held up handfuls of tapeworms from a jar for all to see, and cried out his medicines against them. And they were pressed about by other rude apothecaries, and by vendors and mendicants, until all came at last before a trestle whereon stood a glass carboy of clear mezcal. In this container, with hair afloat and eyes turned upward in a pale face, sat a human head. They dragged him forward with shouts and gestures. "Mire! Mire!" they cried. He stood before the jar, and they urged his consideration of it. and they tilted it around so that the head should face him. It was Captain White, lately at war among the heathen. The kid looked into the drowned and sightless eyes of his old commander. He looked about at the villagers and at the soldiers, their eyes all upon him, and he spat and wiped his mouth.
"He ain't no kin to me," he said.
They put him in an old stone corral with three other ragged refugees from the expedition. They sat stunned and blinking against the wall, or roved the perimeter around in the dry tracks of mules and horses, and retched and shat while small boys hooted from the parapet. He fell in with a thin boy from Georgia.
"I was sicker than a dog," the boy said. "I was afraid I was going to die, and then I was afraid I wasn't. I seen a rider on the captain's horse up in the country from here," the kid told him. "Aye," said the Georgian. "They killed him and Clark, and another boy I never did know his name. We come on into town, and the very next day they had us in the Calabozo, and this selfsame son of a bitch is down there with the guards, laughing and drinking and playing cards, him and the jefe, to see who gets the captain's horse and who gets his pistols. I guess you seen the captain's head."
"I seen it.
That's the worst thing I ever seen in my life."
"Somebody ought to have pickled it a long time ago. By rights they ought to pickle mine. Forever taken up with such a fool."
They drifted as the day advanced from wall to wall to keep out of the sun. The boy from Georgia told him of his comrades displayed on slabs, cold and dead in the market. The captain headless in a wallow, half eaten by hogs. He ran his heel out in the dust and gouged a little place for it to rest.
"They fixin' to send us to Chihuahua City," he said.
"How do you know?"
"That's what they say. I don't know."
"That's what who says?"
"Shipman yonder. He speaks the lingo some."
The kid regarded the man spoken of. He shook his head and spat dryly. All day, small boys perched on the walls and watched them by shifts and pointed and jabbered. They'd walk around the parapet and try to piss down on sleepers in the shade, but the prisoners kept alert. Some at first threw stones, but the kid picked one from the dust the size of an egg, and with it dropped a small child cleanly from the wall with no sound other than the muted thud of its landing on the far side.
"Now you gone and done it," said the Georgian.
The kid looked at him.
"They'll be in here with whips and I don't know what all."
The kid spat.
"They ain't about to come in here and eat no whips."
Nor did they. A woman brought them bowls of beans and charred tortillas on a plate of unfired clay. She looked harried, and she smiled at them, and she had smuggled them sweets under her shawl, and there were pieces of meat in the bottom of the bowls that had come from her own table. 3 days later, mounted on little malandered mules, they set out for the capital, as foretold. They rode 5 days through desert and mountain, and through dusty pueblos where the populace turned out to see them. Their escorts in varied suits of time-worn finery, the prisoners in rags. They'd been given blankets and squatting by the desert fires at night, sun-blackened and bony, and wrapped in these serapes, they looked like God's profoundest peons. The soldiers none spoke English, and they directed their charges with grunts or gestures. They were indifferently armed, and they were much afraid of the Indians. They rolled their tobacco in corn husks, and they sat by the fire in silence and listened to the night. Their talk, when they talked, was of witches or worse, and always they sought to parcel from the darkness some voice or cry from among the cries that was no right beast.
"La gente dice que el coyote es un brujo. Muchas veces el brujo es un coyote. Y los indios también. Muchas veces llaman como los coyotes. ¿Y qué es eso? Nada. Un tecolote, nada más. Quizás."
When they rode through the gap in the mountains and looked down on the city, The sergeant of the expedition halted the horses and spoke to the man behind him, and he in turn dismounted and took rawhide thongs from his saddlebag and approached the prisoners, and gestured for them to cross their wrists and hold them out, showing how with his own hands. He tied them each in this manner, and then they rode on. They entered the city in a gauntlet of flung offal, driven like cattle through the cobbled streets, with shouts going up behind for the soldiery, who smiled as became them, and nodded among the flowers and proffered cups, herding the tattered fortune-seekers through the plaza, where water splashed in a fountain, and idlers reclined on carven seats of white porphyry, and past the governor's palace, and past the cathedral, where vultures squatted along the dusty entablatures, and among the niches in the carved facade hard by the figures of Christ and the apostles, the birds holding out their own dark vestments in postures of strange benevolence, while about them flapped on the wind the dried scalps of slaughtered Indians strung on cords, the long, dull hair swinging like the filaments of certain sea forms, and the dry hides clapping against the stones. They passed old almsseekers by the church door with their seamy palms outheld, and maimed beggars sad-eyed in rags, and children asleep in the shadows with flies walking their dreamless faces. Dark coppers in a clack dish, the shriveled eyes of the blind. Scribes crouched by the steps with their quills and inkpots and bowls of sand, and lepers moaning through the streets, and naked dogs that seem composed of bone entirely, and vendors of tamales, and old women with faces dark and harrowed as the land, squatting in the gutters over charcoal fires, where blackened strips of anonymous meat sizzled and spat. Small orphans were abroad like irate dwarfs, and fools, and sots drooling and flailing about in the small markets of the metropolis. And the prisoners rode past the carnage and the meat stalls and the waxy smell where racks of guts hung black with flies and flayings of meat in great red sheets now darkened with the advancing day, and the flensed and naked skulls of cows and sheep with their dull blue eyes glaring wildly, and the stiff bodies of deer and javelina and ducks and quail and parrots, all wild things from the country round, hanging head downward from hooks. They were made to dismount and were driven afoot through the crowds, and down old stone steps, and over a doorsill worn like soap, and through an iron sally gate into a cool stone cellar, long a prison, to take their place among the ghosts of old martyrs and patriots, while the gate clanked shut behind them. When their eyes lost their blindness, they could make out figures crouched along the wall, stirrings of beds of hay like nesting mice disturbed, a light snoring. Outside, the rattle of a cart and the dull clop of hooves in the street, and through the stones a dim clank of hammers from a smith shop in another part of the dungeon. The kid looked about. Blackened bits of candle wick lay here and there in pools of dirty grease on the stone floor, and strings of dried spittle hung from the walls. A few names scratched where the light could find them out. He squatted and rubbed his eyes. Someone in underwear crossed before him to a pail in the center of the room and stood and pissed. This man then turned and came his way. He was tall and wore his hair to his shoulders. He shuffled through the straw and stood looking down at him. "You don't know me, do you?" he said. The kid spat and squinted up at him. "I know ye," he said. "I'd know your hide in a tanyard." Chapter 6. In the streets. Brass Teeth. Los Hereticos. A veteran of the late war. Mier. Donovan. The Le Pen burial. Gold Seekers. The Scalp Hunters. The Judge. Freed from the prison. Et de ceux se mettent en le pays. With daylight, men rose from the hay and crouched on their haunches and regarded the new arrivals without curiosity. They were half naked, and they sucked their teeth and snuffled and stirred and picked at themselves like apes. A cherry light had washed a high small window from the dark, and an early street vendor had begun to cry his wares. Their morning feed was bowls of cold pignole, and they were fitted with chains and routed out into the streets, clanking and stinking. Overseen all day by a gold-toothed pervert who carried a plaited rawhide quirt and harried them down the gutters on their knees, gathering up the filth. Under the wheels of vending carts, the legs of beggars dragging behind them their sacks of refuse. In the afternoon, they sat in the shade of a wall and ate their dinner and watched two dogs hung together in the street, sidle and step.
"How do you like city life?" said Toadvine. "I don't like it worth a damn so far. I keep waiting for it to take with me, but it ain't done it."
They watched the overseer covertly as he passed, his hands clasped behind his back, his cap cocked over one eye. The kid spat.
"I seen him first," said Toadvine.
"Seen who first?"
"You know who. Old Brass Teeth yonder."
The kid looked after the sauntering figure.
"My biggest worry is that something will happen to him. I pray daily for the Lord to watch over him."
"How you think you're going to get out of this jackpot that you're in?"
"We'll get out. It ain't like the carcel."
"What's the carcel?"
"State penitentiary. There's old pilgrims in there, come down the trail back in the 20s.
The kid watched the dogs. After a while, the guard came back along the wall, kicking the feet of any who were sleeping. The younger guard carried his escopeta at the ready, as if there might be some fabled uprising among these chained and tattered felons.
"Vámonos, vámonos," he called.
The prisoners rose and shuffled out into the sun. A small bell was ringing, and a coach was coming up the street. They stood along the curb and took off their hats. The guidon passed, ringing the bell, and then the coach. It had an eye painted on the side and four mules to draw it, taking the host to some soul. A fat priest tottered after, carrying an image. The guards were going among the prisoners, snatching the hats from the heads of the newcomers and pressing them into their infidel hands. When the coach had passed, they donned their hats again and moved on. The dogs stood tail to tail. Two other dogs sat a little apart, squatting loosely in their skins, just frames of dogs in napless hides, watching the coupled dogs, and then watching the prisoners clanking away up the street. All lightly shimmering in the heat, these life forms, like wonders much reduced. Rough likenesses thrown up at hearsay after the things themselves had faded in men's minds. He'd taken up a pallet between Toadvine and another Kentuckian, a veteran of the war. This man had returned to claim some dark-eyed love he'd left behind 2 years before when Donovan's command pulled east for Saltillo, and the officers had had to drive back hundreds of young girls dressed as boys that took the road behind the army. Now he would stand in the streets, solitary in his chains and strangely unassuming, gazing out across the tops of the heads of the townspeople. And at night he'd tell them of his years in the West, an amiable warrior, a reticent man. He'd been at Mier, where they fought until the drain tiles and the gutters and the spouts from the azoteas ran with blood by the gallon. And he told them how the brittle old Spanish bells would explode when hit, and how he sat against the wall with his shattered legs stretched out on the cobbles before him, listening to a lull in the firing that grew into a strange silence. And in this silence there grew a low rumbling that he took for thunder, until a cannonball came around the corner, trundling over the stones like a wayward bowl, and went past and down the street and disappeared from sight. He told how they'd taken the city of Chihuahua, an army of irregulars that fought in rags and underwear, and how the cannonballs were solid copper, and came loping through the grass like runaway sons. And even the horses learned to sidestep or straddle them. And how the dames of the city rode up into the hills in buggies and picnicked and watched the battle. And how at night as they sat by the fires they could hear the moans of the dying out on the plain, and see by its lantern the dead cart moving among them like a hearse from limbo. "They had gravel enough," said the veteran, "but they didn't know how to fight. They'd stick. You heard stories about how they found them chained to the trail spades of their pieces, limber teams and all. But if they was, I never seen it. We picked powder in the locks yonder, blowed them gates open. People in here look like skinned rats, whitest Mexicans you'll ever see. Throwed themselves down and commenced kissing our feet and such. Old Bill, he just turned them all loose. Hell, he didn't know what they'd done, just told them not to steal nothing. Of course, they stole everything they could get their hands on. Whipped two of them, and they both died of it. And the very next day, another bunch run off with some mules, and Bill just flat out hung them fools. Which they did likewise perish of. But I never reckoned I'd be in here my own self." They were squatting cross-legged by candlelight, eating from clay bowls with their fingers. The kid looked up. He poked at the bowl. "What is this?" he said. "That's prime bull meat, son, from the corrida. You'll get it of a Sunday night. You best keep chewing. Don't let it feel you to weaken." He chewed. He chewed and he told them of the encounter with the Comanche, and they chewed and listened and nodded. "I'm proud I missed that dance," said the veteran. "Damn you, some cruel sons of bitches. I know of one old boy up on the Llano near the Dutch settlements. They caught him, took his horse and all, left him to walk it. He come crawling into Fredericksburg on his hands and knees, buck naked, about 6 days later. And you know what they'd done? Cut the bottoms of his feet off." Toadvine shook his head. He gestured toward the veteran. "Granny Rat here knows him," he told the kid. "Fought him. Ain't you, Granny?" The veteran waved his hand. "Shot some stealing horses is all, down towards Saltillo. Wasn't nothing to it. There was a cave down there. Had been a Le Pan burial. Must have been 1,000 Indians in there all setting around. Had on their best robes and blankets and all. Had their bows and their knives, whatever, and beads. The Mexicans carried everything off, stripped them naked, took it all. They carried off whole Indians to their homes and set them in the corner all dressed up, but they begun to come apart when they got out of that cave air, and they had to be thrown out. Towards the last of it, there was some Americans went in there and scalped what was left of them and tried to sell the scalps in Durango. I don't know if they had any luck about it or not. I expect some of them Indians had been dead 100 years. Toadvine was toweling up grease from his bowl with a folded tortilla. He squinted at the kid in the candlelight. "What do you reckon we could get for old Breast Teeth's teeth?" he said. They saw patched Argonauts from the States driving mules through the streets on their way south through the mountains to the coast. Gold seekers. Itinerant degenerates bleeding westward like some heliotropic plague. They nodded or spoke to the prisoners and dropped tobacco and coins in the street beside them. They saw black-eyed young girls with painted faces smoking little cigars, going arm in arm and eyeing them brazenly. They saw the governor himself, erect and formal within his silk-mullioned sulky, clatter forth from the double doors of the palace courtyard. And they saw one day a pack of vicious-looking humans mounted on unshod Indian ponies riding half-drunk through the streets, bearded, barbarous, clad in the skins of animals stitched up with thews and armed with weapons of every description. Revolvers of enormous weight and bowie knives the size of claymores and short two-barreled rifles with bores you could stick your thumbs in. And the trappings of their horses fashioned out of human skins, and their bridles woven up from human hair and decorated with human teeth. and the riders wearing scapulars or necklaces of dried and blackened human ears. And the horses raw-looking and wild in the eye, and their teeth bared like feral dogs. And riding also in the company a number of half-naked savages reeling in the saddle, dangerous, filthy, brutal. The whole like a visitation from some heathen land where they and others like them